Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indie Radio, we're talking about the challenges of the local restaurant business, but also about the creative process that goes into it all. Plus, we'll hear from a young food professional who was just named a finalist on an impressive nationwide list. First, we'll be talking with chef and restaurateur Neil Brown to get his take on the Indianapolis dining scene, and we'll talk with him as well about the creative challenges of the restaurant business and about his next restaurant, Yukio. Then we'll revisit an interview with Potashew Foundation Executive Director Matthew Feltrip. When we talked back in April, he had just been named one of 60 semifinalists on Zagat's 30 Under 30 list of young food professionals across the nation. But just this week, he made the list of 45 finalists, and we'll hear about the work of the Potashew Foundation that put him on the list. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Talking today here on Eat Drink Indie Radio with chef and restaurateur Neil Brown, one of Indy's most high-profile chefs. He came up through the ranks of local kitchens, opened restaurants for other owners, and has opened and closed some of his own as well. It's not an easy business, and today's challenging restaurant climate is making it even tougher. Neil tells us just how hard it is right now, what it's like to open and, yes, close a restaurant, and why he can't help but keep at it.
It's a tough time, right? I think everyone is feeling it. I have spoken with many of my sort of restaurateur counterparts across the city. And I think everyone's kind of feeling something. There's a little blip in the radar where we're sort of all kind of going, yeah, something's not right. I've heard lots of theories. I think some prevailing theories are that it's an adjustment in the market.
Right.
After
much growth, right?
After this significant growth we've had, I think some people have just flat out said, well, the restaurants weren't very good that closed, which I think is a little extreme because they were good restaurants. There are lots of theories, but I don't think that it's even possible to say that it's all one thing. I think if there's one common sort of denominator that probably runs through all of the closings we've seen is cash, right?
Undercapitalization?
Undercapitalization. Or just a lack of cash. Maybe it's not undercapitalization because maybe they went into their business with plenty of money. But, you know, businesses, restaurants particularly, consume cash cyclically. Right. Sometimes you're cash poor. Sometimes you're cash rich.
Oh, sure. So
it's seasonal.
A seasonal thing. So lack of cash is a very simple.
It can
simple
be.
Kind
yeah.
Of,
and, you know,
problem.
I think, you know, John Adams was quoted as saying he just didn't feel like he could look his investors in the eye and ask for another $100,000. Right.
Now, how is that? You have dealt with this sort of situation for a long time. You have opened restaurants. You've
closed restaurants. More restaurants than most people around this town. Yeah. Yeah.
So you have investors. So you know you must know what that feels like.
Yeah, it is awful. It is. You feel the failure. I mean, it really washes over you, and it's not, you know, when you close a restaurant, it's not like you just close the restaurant and you walk away.
Okay, so
it's not that tidy.
Talk a little bit about that, because we're referring to L'Explorateur, which was one of the trend-setting the restaurants. It was, way out in front of the curve, I think, on a lot of food trends here in Indianapolis, doing some really incredible things, and yet it closed.
And yet 2008 happened, right?
I do sort of
attribute 2008 to the closure of L'Explorateur. Though, it's worth saying now, and in total fairness, we were undercapitalized. We were a classic example.
So that is a, like you said, a classic example.
We didn't have the money to weather the storm. And that's what this is really all about, is having the cash to weather the storm and coming up with creative ways to weather the storm. You have to get creative. But to speak to actually closing a restaurant, it is not tidy. It's really messy. It feels bad. It just, there's nothing about it except for the struggle. There's nothing good about it.
So it's when you stop struggling, right?
You feel this release. You feel this weight being lifted off your shoulders because you no longer have to go in every day and succumb to that pressure. The pressure is overwhelming when you're closing a restaurant. It's just overwhelming. It's almost intolerable.
The build-up to that?
Yeah, the build-up, because you're dealing with lots of vendors who are calling you and asking you for money, and they're demanding payment. You've got to be answering to your partners. If you have a bank involved, you got to be keeping the bank very much in the loop. You've got to be worrying about your family because chances are, as an entrepreneur, you're the first person that actually stops getting paid. So you're not having any personal income coming into your household. So the stress level is tenfold, right? It's coming at you from every direction. And this is not unique to a restaurant.
Well,
this
right.
is unique
this
to
is
any
to
entrepreneurial.
An entrepreneur, small business owner. Right?
Yeah, yeah. So you're getting it from all directions. It's incredibly stressful. And it goes on for months because you have to liquidate assets, right? You have to figure out if you're going to deliver the space back to the landlord in what condition, right? If there's a bank involved, the bank has to decide how best to liquidate the assets of the business. And you're responsible. If you're a good entrepreneur and you plan on living to fight another day, you're going to take it upon yourself to create a scenario where they are very comfortable with what you've left behind. You create an inventory of everything. So that means you're going through and doing all of that. So it's not tidy. It's
so
just
you
not
don't just
an easy,
cut and run.
You don't just cut and run. And some people have been able to do that. You know, I feel good that Craig and Scott at Long Branch and John both were able to sort of transfer their restaurants over to new ownership, because
that's right.
that transfer is actually pretty key, because that gets them off the hook from a lease standpoint. Some landlords, you know, if they've personally guaranteed these leases, the landlord has every legal right to come after you for the full value of the lease, and that means 5 years of paying maybe $90,000 a year, maybe $150,000 a year.
Oh my goodness.
So, you know, if any new startup, entrepreneurial, sort of spirited chef most likely is going to have to sign a personal guarantee on a lease, and that is a legally binding contract.
So you are guaranteeing that lease will be paid for X, whatever the extent
until,
of the lease is.
And usually it's until someone leases the space. So, you know, in the middle of all of this, you become a broker and a leasing agent.
So you're
as
trying
well.
To find someone to take you're over the space?
It.
Oh, my goodness.
Right. And then you have to convince someone why they should take it when you couldn't.
So they will succeed.
They will succeed
right.
when you couldn't. Right?
Oh my goodness!
Yeah. So it's very frustrating. It's really tough. Really, really tough.
So you know what these people have been going through lately when we talk about some of the high profile closures.
Oh man, I've instant messaged these guys and the people that I know and just said, look, I'm really sorry. There's nothing you can really do to help people. But, you know, just to say, I'm really sorry. And, man, that feels so insignificant to say that. It just feels so just – those aren't strong enough words, right? I just wish there were other words. Because it's – that's your – you know, I'm sitting here with my son next to me here. But it's a loss. It's a personal loss because it's your – it's your dignity. It is your identity, because that restaurant has been part of you for so long. It is part of you, and you're saying goodbye to that part of you, at least for the short time. And so, it's tough. It's really, really tough. Yeah.
So why do people do it?
Because we love it. Every time I open a new restaurant, I say this is the last restaurant I'm opening.
Now, how many have you opened?
Not as many as I've closed. No, that's
no,
that's not true.
That's not really
true. That's not true. I guess I've opened what, five now? Five restaurants? And that's not, that's only my restaurants. I've been involved in many,
right, you've
many
been
other
in the openings.
Openings
of other restaurants.
Yeah. And so, no, we do it because the challenge. We do it because...
do you do it because it's our, this is what you do?
It's what we do. It's, I mean, I think there are chefs who sort of love to open restaurants like I do. And I do love restaurants. I mean, I love everything about a restaurant. And I think there are chefs that love being on the line. You know, I think the Greg Hardesty's and the Dave Talents of the world, are their proudest moments are that those guys never miss a service, right?
Right.
So there's that kind of chef. One is no better than the other, but it's just a different philosophy, a different way of thinking.
And you like the opening, the challenges involved in all that? You know, the
worst part of it? Yeah.
Right, the worst part of it.
Yeah, I don't love that part. I really, truly don't. I love restaurants, and I love when a restaurant is running smoothly.
And what's that like? Speak a little bit about when it's good, you know, because that must feed something.
Yeah, when it's good, it feels really good, you know, and that's when you can look around and when I talk about this, sometimes I talk about it in terms of golf, right?
Okay.
A great night at a restaurant is like a game of golf. It's like you really strike the ball well, and that one strike can get you through three, four, maybe five more holes before you need that next strike where it's just perfect, or not even just perfect, but just really good enough,
right,
to propel you through the rest of the game, right? It's a little bit like that. When you have a night that's just on and everything is falling into place and service is great, you just feel it. You feel it. Everyone feels it. The restaurant's got a vibe. It's got a buzz. The guests have a different vibe and a different buzz. That's what we all chase. I mean, that's literally what we're all chasing all the time.
We've been talking with chef and restaurateur Neil Brown of Pizzology, Stella, and the Libertine Liquor Bar. Stay with us for more from Neil about restaurant culture and his next restaurant, Yukio, when we're back here on eDrink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Katzenberger, and we are back today talking with chef and restaurateur Neil Brown of Pizzology, Stella, and the Libertine Liquor Bar about culture. What is a restaurant's culture and why is it important? Neil tells us about building a team, creating that culture, and trying to capture the magic.
Well, now, what's the magic? How do you get that? You've said before that getting a team together is one of the biggest challenges.
So you hear a lot these days about culture, right? And culture is repetition over time to create something that is habitual. So to me, that's what we try to achieve. We try to every day go in and say, this is how we do this. That's why when you get a chef that goes a little rogue or wants to, you know, a lot of times you get young chefs that want to come in and they're working your recipe. I've had chefs where I look over and a young chef will start to do something different. And I'll be like, what are you doing? He's like, well, I just thought it would kind of be good with a little dill. And I'm like, do you enjoy life? You know, do you want to see your next birthday?
So improvising is not necessarily a good thing.
No, there's a time and place for it. And we encourage it. But it's not during service. Right. And so it's making sure that consistency is happening all the time. That's sort of your trademark. You just want to strive for consistency. And then consistency over time. Consistency of consistency over time. And that's what Pizzology Carmel has achieved. You know, we worked intensely for 3 years. Lindy and I were at that restaurant for 3 years, day in, day out. And over that course of time, you create these habits in people, and they know what is expected of them, and they come in and they do their job. And you just then at that point, you're just kind of moving them a little left or a little right and making these small adjustments.
So it must be great when you have that team that can do that. But that it seems like that might be kind of a rare thing.
It is rare. It's totally achievable, though, because we've achieved it several times. But it's not easy. It's just it's getting the right people in the right seats on the bus, right? It's that whole idea of, yeah, there are good people, but they have to be the right fit for what they're doing too.
That culture thing. Now, how do you describe your culture? What is a restaurant's culture?
Well, again, our culture. Well, we talk, and there are soft skills to culture, right? And then there are the sort of the hard skills to what we do. The hard skills are you have to come in and you have to go through and execute on your job. You have to come in. You know, the technical training, you have to know your wine list, you know, have to know all the steps of service. You have to know what the touch points are in the restaurant so that you can identify when a touch point is out of place.
What's
right?
a touch point?
Anytime a guest has an interaction with your brand, is what we consider a touch point.
Oh, okay. So like when I'm looking at the menu, for example.
Looking at the menu. If there's a wine glass stain on a menu, someone failed. That's a misstep.
Okay.
If someone isn't smiling when they answer the phone, that would be considered a misstep. And so having people that can identify those things, of course, that is the individual's responsibility, but it's also the manager's responsibility and ultimately my responsibility. And so, you know, just identifying those things and making those corrections. And again, over time, as you create that repetition and that consistency, we now have it where new hostess hires will come in and the hostesses will train that hostess. And we have, at Pizzology Carmel, we have a legacy hostess program. We have literally young girls who have, and some boys who have started at Pizzology Carmel as hostesses will work there 3 to 4 years. And as they go off to college, they will bring in their replacement. It might be
nice.
A younger sister.
Right.
And this has happened many, many, many times.
So this is the sort of thing you want.
Yeah.
Right?
It's fantastic.
You want your people to be bringing in more people.
Absolutely. And it's just this really, really rich culture. You can sense it. When I go up there, I often say that when I go up there, I feel so awkward. I am the most awkward person when I go up there because I literally have nothing to do.
Well, that's good, though, right?
It's great, but it's very awkward. I stand like I'm not good at standing. I'm not good at schmoozing, right? So I usually stand at the wall as they're coming out of the kitchen, and I stand there and I watch them, and they're not doing anything wrong, and I just stand there, and it's great. It's a beautiful thing to witness, but it's pretty awkward too.
Well, how do you create something new? You know, something out of nothing.
Yeah, that's really hard. I'll use Stella as an example. With Stella, I want Stella, and I've made some missteps here, and we can talk about those if you want to. But with Stella, I wanted Stella to be every person's restaurant.
Okay.
Right?
Now, this is the restaurant you've changed the Pizzology downtown on Mass Ave, closed, rebranded as Stella.
Stella, yes. And so I wanted Stella to really be that sort of bistro brasserie type affair where, you know, we would love to be able to expand our service all the way into breakfast. So a 3-service-a-day restaurant. If you wanted to go and sit and have coffee and work on your laptop, we would be a place where we could do that, right? And we're actively talking about how we could sort of make people feel at home in that space to do that. So with that knowledge, right? So there's the premise of the
right.
restaurant, and the story is that, you know, I created a story. There's actually I hired Metonymy Media to write a story of Stella, right? So that sets the stage. Stella is this very sort of free-spirited bohemian woman who traveled Europe drinking wine, breaking hearts, and learning to cook and falling in love with the food of Southern Europe, right? And then
okay.
she came back and she opens this restaurant. By the way, I also came over time realized that, holy cow, I'm really talking about Alice Waters here. And so that's the premise, right? And so you just have to get everyone on board with the message of the restaurant, that it's casual yet calculated service, and that each person on the floor should really represent Stella. And by that, I mean learn people's names. This is make it their restaurant. This isn't a formal place. This isn't a stuffy place. This is a place where we would love to have people coming in eating lunch, and they may go home and say to their wife, "Oh man, I had lunch at Stella today." And then she's like, "Oh, that sounds great. I want to go back tonight." And the other person go, "Yeah, awesome." Right? So it has to be approachable.
Right. So not a special occasion place at all.
Not at all. Not at all. No. And so, you know, to create that culture, it was really, and we still are, trust me, we're very young.
So
we're
a work in progress. Right?
Absolutely. And this will be a work in progress for forever, you know. But it's about being friendly. It's about just doing the things that kind people do. Introducing yourself. We're kind of talking about the potential of maybe offering to shake hands with people as they sit across the bar and introducing yourself as the bartender. Sometimes that can come off pretty insincere, disingenuous. So you have to calculate that. And if it's not the right fit for a particular server, then that server doesn't do it, right? So sincerity is key in these situations. And so those are the kinds of things we talk about. How can we do things where we're genuine, where we're sincere? Because that's what places like that ooze. That's what places like that you go back to time and time again because of that connection you feel.
Because it feels,
with the people.
So you feel something, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. 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 I think that's something that Indianapolis is kind of figuring out right now. Because we have so many options, I think what we're starting to realize, certainly in our organization, this is going to sound like maybe a slant on some restaurants, and I don't mean it that way, but that it's not always about the food, it's about a feeling. A restaurant is a holistic experience. The food doesn't have to be the star of that experience, even though you're going to a restaurant.
That is absolutely right, because you remember the way they made you feel.
Totally. Yeah. If you have a fantastic server, you know, you're going to remember that server, and you may not remember that you had the schnitzel. You may not remember what you ate, but you're going to remember that person. You're going to remember that connection. And that feeling is, I think, something that people are really starting to take notice of.
We've been talking with chef and restaurateur Neil Brown. You can find out more about Neil at neilbrownhospitality.com or look for him on Facebook. And stay with us for more on Neil's next restaurant, Yukio, here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Restaurateur Neil Brown of Pizzology and Carmel and Stella and the Libertine Liquor Bar downtown will soon be turning his attention to his next restaurant, Yukio. That project, a Japanese-inspired, seasonally focused restaurant, will be located at 49th and College Avenue in Indianapolis. We talked with Neil about the creative process, how he starts when thinking about a new restaurant or even a new menu, how he visualizes a dish, and how it all plays into creating Yukio.
Well, talk a little bit about the creative process when it comes to maybe all the way from envisioning a restaurant to creating a menu. Where do you start?
So, well, I'm a very visual learner.
I mean, like drawing?
Pictures? No, yeah. Images, imagery.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in images. I taste visually. And so I see, I tend to see flavor, right? Sometimes when I describe it to my wife, like I'm talking about how when I taste wine, I actually see kind of a heartbeat line.
Okay.
And acid and sweetness tend to go up and down on my sort of, and then, you know, if it's something that is a very, really great wine, it's not sharp at all. It's actually quite, it's more of a sloping sort of line.
I see it.
Yeah. So,
I see it, right? So I'm trying to see what you're describing,
yeah.
Which is a taste.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah. Typically for me, if it looks like whatever you call a
monitor, a heart rate monitor, right.
The more it looks like that, probably the less I like that wine. The more smooth
like
those
that.
Lines are,
okay.
I tend to like those wines a little bit more. And so I taste food very much in the same way. Balance is key. For me, I like balanced food. But the creative process for me is it starts with immersing myself into whatever it is that I want to sort of tackle, right? So this morning, I got up this morning and I laid in bed until probably too late, 9:30, while my wife was getting ready. I laid in bed and I literally watched YouTube videos of Japanese chefs making sushi, watched YouTube videos of guys making yakitori, and just immersed myself in video. And so as I'm starting to turn my attention towards Yukio, I've watched every episode of Inaka on Chef's Table. So I'm just I start to seek out all of these sort of Japanese influences, right?
So this is in preparation for your next restaurant, Yukio.
For Yukio,
Japanese,
yeah.
Japanese restaurant, Japanese inspired restaurant. How would you describe it?
Japanese inspired.
Okay.
Because I feel strongly that Japanese food is about time and place. It is a seasonal cuisine, and it is a cuisine that is identified very much by its place, right? Osaka makes very different food than Tokyo. So just like any other classic cuisine in any other country, you know, Rome is different than Naples, right? So time and place is very important, and so that's kind of how I'm approaching Yukio. We're lucky in the sense that we have ingredients in Indiana that speak very well to the Japanese sort of aesthetic and the flavor palette of Japanese cuisine. I feel like we can execute very, very well. I'm excited about it. I think we're approaching it in the right way.
Which is how?
You know, this is really cliche, but we're going to use Indiana ingredients to make, you know, Japanese food. But yet we're going to have sushi, right?
So now, is that an unusual juxtaposition? You know,
yeah,
a local farm-to-table restaurant that is not American food?
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. But we're certainly not advertising this as a farm-to-table restaurant either.
That's one of those overused cliches, but you are going to focus on local ingredients.
Yeah. I mean, for us, it's a foregone conclusion, right?
Right. So we just assume that these days.
Yeah. We don't really talk about it. It's just part of what we do. It's part of our culture. So
right,
we don't really talk about it. So, yeah, it is. It's weird. And I am conflicted about this. And I've got to reconcile that. I've got to reconcile that somehow. And I will. I think through it a lot.
But you have a long history with Japanese cuisine, right? Tell
me
a little bit about your background.
Well, I was working with Greg Hardesty for 6 years, almost 6 years, until he fired me.
Now that was H2O sushi,
legend has
right?
it that he fired me, but I might say that I quit. I'm not sure. We're not sure. No one can remember that night. That fateful evening. Greg's slant at H2O was, it's called Nikkei mm-hmm. cuisine, right? And it's Peruvian-inspired Japanese food. And I always felt like Greg sort of gravitated towards that Nikkei-style sushi. And what I mean by that is he wasn't afraid to use some root vegetables. He wasn't afraid to use cilantro, certainly. Herbs were a really prominent sort of part of what he did from a sushi standpoint. And so I learned all that, and that was fascinating to me. That was his aesthetic. And we will definitely have our own aesthetic. We're going to focus a little bit more on wild foods, foraged foods. We've been working very closely, especially this summer. It's gotten very intense lately, working with three different foragers.
Oh, interesting.
Uh-huh. Yep. And so we did a dish a few nights ago for the ACLU dinner that I thought was just it was a Stella dish, but secretly I was so happy about it because
right?
of what we were able to achieve from a Yukio standpoint. We did fried milkweed buds that were just delicious as this little crunchy garnish on this tartine. We pickled lily blossoms that were just delicious. And so, you know, you do all these kinds of little things. You know, that's kind of where my head is. We achieved a really, really, I thought, very special dish. I thought it was a great dish.
So how does that process continue as you envision the restaurant? I assume you'll be starting with the decor and mm-hmm. you know how it's going to look and how it's going to feel and concurrently with the menu. So how does that process continue?
Well, like I said, I've stopped designing restaurants. I have this picture in my head. I always develop this picture in my head when I'm opening a new place, right? And I've learned that I have to let go of that because I've been disappointed. Sometimes I'm so fixated on the mental image that I can't get past the practicality of what the place needs to do, right? And so I've made that mistake several times. And so with this one, I'm just sort of entrusting Blackline to sort of make this space beautiful. Our goal with Yukio is to make it a space that is comfortable, that is casual for now, but can morph into something finer as we grow and as we evolve our cuisine. I've made sort of no bones about the fact that I have ambitions for Yukio.
Well, tell me about your ambitions for Yukio.
Well, I initially started by saying that I really wanted it to be a very high-end restaurant. And I don't know what that means, but I know that I wanted it to have very technical food, very sort of complex food. You know, lots of touches, lots of things like that, right? So really magnificent food. This recent spate of restaurant closings has certainly made me rethink this idea.
How so?
I'm just not sure people want it.
Well, we have that conversation usually when a restaurant closes, well, they weren't ready for my cuisine or something like
that.
Yeah,
I don't think it's a matter of being ready. I think it's about people not wanting it. There's nothing wrong with the Indianapolis diner. I mean, there are lots of people who are very sophisticated diners in this city. I know you can get frustrated when you close a place and you can say some things. And I've said these things in the past. You know, you get mad, you say things you don't mean. And, you know, the thing you want to say is, darn you, Indianapolis, why didn't you support me? Because that's how you feel. But there are people who are willing to come out and take a risk. You don't get places like Milktooth and Bluebeard and Rook, places that are, you know, that I think push the boundaries of their cuisine. They're being fully supported, you know. These are places that they have as free rein as they want to do the things they want to do.
And people have come along with them.
And people have come along with them, right. So it's not fair to say that people aren't ready, and I didn't necessarily mean that. I think it's just that maybe they don't want certain things, and they vote with their dollars. No one's going to walk into your restaurant and be like, we don't want this, sorry.
So they're not going to tell you.
They're not going to tell you. Yeah, they're just not going to come back, right? And that's terrifying. So, yeah. So, you know, we are trying to evolve Yukio right now. We don't have to evolve it much. It's always meant to be a place that was going to be comfortable. And we don't want it to feel and look like a Japanese restaurant. That's what I do know.
Oh, no, that's interesting. So it's going to be a Japanese-inspired restaurant that doesn't look like a Japanese restaurant?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's important to me for it not to be overtly Japanese. I'm not Japanese. I don't speak Japanese. Yeah, it needs to feel comfortable. It needs to, you know, you got to know your market. You got to know what people want. And we're going to try to keep it very affordable. Our goal is to stay in business long enough to give ourselves the opportunity to evolve.
We've been talking today with chef and restaurateur Neil Brown of Pizzology, Stella, the Libertine Liquor Bar, and the soon-to-come Yukio. For more information on Neil and his restaurants, check out neilbrownhospitality.com. Last week, Zagat, the publisher of dining guides and restaurant ratings, announced the finalists for its 30 Under 30 list, a nationwide roundup of young food business professionals. When the semi-finalist list was released back in April, we talked with one of the indie professionals who made the list, Matthew Feltrip, executive director of the Potashoe Foundation. Now he's moved up to finalist status, so we're revisiting that interview to hear just how Matthew reacted to making the original list.
Yeah, I was really honored to be listed as a semi-finalist for Zagat's 30 Under 30 and the Food Award for the Nation.
Well, that's pretty impressive, and you are on a list of some pretty impressive people, and we do have someone else here in Indianapolis. Hattie McDaniel, a pastry chef here in Indianapolis, is also on the list, which is very cool. But tell me about finding yourself on that list. I mean, that's a great roster.
It really is, and I'm totally blown away to be listed among some of those people. So I think it's just a testament to being a part of a really great organization and really sticking to what we do best, which is serving the meals that we're making for kids. So I'm really honored to be on that list.
Was it really a surprise?
It was totally a surprise. I got a text message from someone who works at the cafes and said, "Hey, you're on this list." And I was like, "Whoa, that's totally awesome." So definitely blown away.
So what was the reaction amongst the family?
Well, I have to tell you, I have a huge cheerleading squad in my family. My mother and my sister and Martha Hoover and everyone here at the company just has been a really great support, and it's been pretty incredible just to hear that support come out of the woodwork.
So what's your background? How long have you been with the foundation?
Well, I've been with the foundation for about 2.5 years now, so not quite since it began, but almost right after that. I actually started working with Potashoe Company about 3.5-4 years ago, and I started in the restaurants. I really caught the vision of what the foundation was from the very beginning, but it was really small. We were serving maybe 35 kids every week at one location, and since then we've grown to 8 locations. So at the point when I joined Potashoe, it was so nascent that I was really just kind of investing my time as a volunteer. And when I started with Potashoe, I actually worked at Petit Chou and Napoli's and really fell in love with what Potashoe stands for and the company culture.
So what's your background? Did you have a background in food service?
Not at all. A little bit. I had worked in high school in food and really thought that that's kind of where I wanted to go. And just life took me in a different path. I was actually working at a school on the West Side. I was teaching Spanish and was the head of their language department, but I also got involved in their development department. And so my background was really a little bit different. I had always been involved with nonprofits, education, and so that's kind of what I took from all of my past experiences and have brought to the table here.
So it's not that different, not that much of a stretch to find yourself working with the Potashoe organization. What was it like starting out? You mentioned at the beginning of the foundation launch. How was that?
Well, it was really incredible because Martha Hoover, who started the foundation and also owns and manages the restaurants, has a really incredible vision for the company, but also for the Potashoe Foundation. So the experience at the beginning of the foundation was really special because it was a time to set vision and to create something that was immediately impactful. And so I think Martha often tells this story that she had the idea for the foundation, and I think within 3 or 4 months began serving meals to kids. So Martha doesn't mess around, and I was really excited to be a part of an organization that, you know, has that nimbleness.
So you can get things done.
Absolutely, and really do things efficiently. It's been exciting to kind of see the principles of business, and this is something that really ties back into our speakers forum, because we think that when you're creating a nonprofit organization and you're creating social impact, you have to do it in a way that's sustainable. And so it's been really exciting to work with Martha and our board of directors and community supporters who really want to see us create an organization that doesn't just create an organization, but that creates impact in the city.
So what's been your reaction to working within the Indianapolis food community? What's your take on what's going on right now?
I think we're at a really exciting point. Like I said, we're in the middle of the breadbasket of America. There's a lot of agriculture that happens in Indiana. But it hasn't necessarily trickled down when we talk about education and into all of the neighborhoods of the city. So I think that we are a part of a few different organizations. The main one is the Indianapolis Food Council, the Indy Food Council. And it's been exciting to see that organization grow. And we're looking at, you know, the local food production and creating a market here for local foods and making sure that it's accessible for everyone.
Do you see the Patashou Foundation and its mission to feed food insecure children, do you see that as replicable someplace else, scalable to other cities?
Absolutely. I think there's a definite model that we have that other people could duplicate in any city. If you can't duplicate what you're doing it the wrong way. It can't depend on one person. It can't depend on, you know, just some secret sauce. It has to be that you have a formula, and that's what we've kind of created here.
We're talking today with Matthew Feltrip, Executive Director of the Patashou Foundation, and now a finalist on Zagat's list of 30 Under 30 Young Food Biz Professionals. We'll be back with more from Matthew about his work with the Patashou Foundation here on eDrink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on eDrink Indie Radio talking today with Matthew Feltrip, Executive Director of the Patashou Foundation. You're probably familiar with the Cafe Patashou restaurant, started by restaurateur Martha Hoover in 1989, as well as her Petite Chou Bistro, Napoli's Pizzerias, and Public Greens, an urban kitchen with a mission. We're talking today with Matthew about that mission and about how the Patashou Foundation is working to help alleviate childhood hunger here in Indianapolis.
The Patashou Foundation, as the name might suggest, grew out of Patashou Incorporated, the restaurants here in Indianapolis. Cafe Patashou, Napoli's, Public Greens, Petite Chou, and Bar 114 and Crispy Bird soon to come. So
it was a desire to give back to the community?
Absolutely. There was a desire to give back to the community, but also a desire to connect with the mission of the company itself. And Patashou has made a name for itself with quality food, quality service, and being radically better and different than other restaurants in town. So the vision was, let's make something that is relatable to the organization or the company, but most importantly, let's make something that's impactful in the city.
So you're sending out to address a particular problem. Talk a little bit about the mission.
Yeah, so Indianapolis is really unique, and people who are familiar with the way that Indianapolis is laid out will know that Indianapolis is ranked as the worst food access city in the United States, which is deplorable. We're sitting in the middle of the breadbasket of America, and we have neighborhoods that don't have access to fresh foods. When you couple that with some really high poverty areas in the city, and the fact that kids don't know sometimes where their dinner is coming from, there's a real hunger crisis in the city. There's a nutrition crisis, and so we're addressing that issue by serving wholesome meals to kids that are prepared in the Patashou kitchens. And we use the same high-quality ingredients that you would be familiar with in any of the Patashou restaurants. And we deliver them to kids and serve it to them because kids deserve to have that kind of empowered meal.
Now, how did that start? So kind of the background and when and how. I mean, tackling childhood hunger, that's a very big problem.
It's a huge problem, and I think the statistics that really show that in Indianapolis are the obesity and diabetes among youth, which is pretty staggering when you compare it to the rest of the country. Martha Hoover had the vision 4 years ago to start the Patashou Foundation to address poverty, homelessness, and hunger in the city. So we partner with 8 different schools here in Indianapolis, and we have literally an army of 125 volunteers, and we're always looking for new volunteers. But these volunteers really help us do the work of the foundation. Those schools that we partner with run after-school activities. These are scouts, these are rocket clubs, these are just enrichment programs, tutoring. Every student who's there after school in those 8 schools, we feed them a meal. So we work with them to figure out how many kids are going to be there each day, and we prepare the meals and then deliver them to the schools, and then the volunteers help us serve the kids a plate. And it's really important for us to give a kid a plate of food, because just the reality of kind of scale production for kids, kids' meals just in general, this might be the only meal that they get that's on a plate, that's not wrapped in cellophane, that doesn't have a wrapper around it. So it's important for us to kind of give them that experience at the table. And so volunteers help us make that happen. And then at the same time, maybe before or after the meal, we will work with some of the kids once a week on some of those education topics that we talk about. And so we have volunteers and educators that help us do that.
Now, I think people are probably interested in knowing what kind of food are you making for the kids after school. So this isn't kids' meal kind of food, is it?
Well, it's not kids' meal kind of food, but it is a kid-friendly menu that we're making. So we always try to include 4 different elements in the meal. There's a whole grain. There is a serving of vegetable, a serving of fruit, and then there's a high-quality protein that we put in there. So the meals, like I said, use the same ingredients that you would get at a pot au chou restaurant, but not necessarily the same menu. So we have barbecue chicken wraps that we serve kids, Italian meatball slider that we serve with bread that our baker in-house makes for us. So really kind of kid-friendly items, but we know that they're nutrient-packed.
And high quality, coming out of the pot au chou kitchens, right?
Without a doubt, yes. And we really make sure that the kids are responding to the meals as well. So there's certainly a learning curve when we start presenting meals to kids that might look a little bit different than they've had before. You know, a turkey sandwich on house-made scratch wheat bread is probably going to look a little bit different than the bread that they might be familiar with. So it's a lot of education that we do, and making sure that our volunteers are empowered to kind of present food in a really friendly manner, and really know how to talk to kids about food, because we want kids to know that it's okay to have their own taste. It's okay if they don't like things, but we want to be open and exploring, and that's how that they're going to end up changing habits in the long run.
So what's been the reaction among the kids to the after-school meals, and probably the differentness of the after-school meals?
It's really exciting, because given that we've been in some of these schools for 4 years, now we have a track record with the kids. And those schools that we've been in the longest really anticipate us being there. The kids the older ones will kind of talk to the younger ones, and we try to put them next to each other if it's possible, so that they can kind of teach them the ways of starting to like this food, because I'm sure that you're familiar with how kids eat. If one kid at a table says, oh my gosh, this is not good, every other kid has the same reaction. It's kind of like a peer pressure thing, but I also think it's just really they don't want to have to, you know, try something new if not everyone else is going to do it. So we work really hard at kind of setting the environment when we're working with them. But the end of the day, kids love the meals. So they often we'll get little notes from kids that say, they'll come back with all of our dirty dishes that we have, and we'll have a note that says, like, please send more taco salad. And so those little handwritten notes just, like, let us know that we're doing something that's making an impact on them.
the question then becomes, how do you manage to do this as far as the funding for this? Because it's an awesome mission to do it. But tell me how you manage to make this happen financially.
Right. And I'm sure that people who are listening to this will definitely understand that good food isn't cheap. So that's a really great question. We have a unique partnership with Potashu Restaurants, specifically Public Greens, the one right off of the Monon Trail in Broad Ripple, dedicates 100% of their profits to the foundation, which is incredible, but it doesn't cover all of our expenses. And the gap that we fill is really through events like the fundraiser and individual donors. So we have a lot of people who are giving $10, $12, $25 a month, $100 a month, $1,000 a month. And those are helping us pay for these meals. So those funders and those individuals are engaged with us in that donor relationship because they believe in what we're doing and they know that we're going to make the most use out of their investment in the organization.
We've been talking with Matthew Feltrip, Executive Director of the Potashu Foundation and a finalist on Zagat's 30 Under 30 list of young food business professionals. For more information on Matthew and the work that the foundation does, go to thepotashufoundation.org. I'm Jolene Katzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, and Do Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning into our show today on restaurants, food, inspiration, and doing good for the community. And thanks also to our guests, chef and restaurateur Neil Brown of Pizzology, Stella, The Libertine, and the soon-to-come Yukio, and Matthew Feltrip, executive director of the Potashu Foundation. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, and D Radio.